So hello, you're all very welcome. I Spray My Mental Health podcast, episode 8. An assemblage of ill-educated ramblings about life, poetry, psychology, philosophy, and other stuff that's shiny and distracting. So you're all very welcome. I'm joined once again by my co-host, Aidan Quinn, in the hub. And if you want context on that reference, please go back to last week's episode. Actually, no. Go back to episode 1. Go back to the start. Go back to the beginning. You wouldn't start a Netflix series on episode 8, would you now? So go back, binge, listen. Discover the tone, the pace, the character behind what exactly is going on here. And if you figure that out, please let me know, because I haven't got a clue what I'm doing. I basically just found a new toy that makes me sound and feel half intelligent, and I'm rolling with it. And that's where I'm at. So we reached a very pleasant milestone last week. 500 downloads of the podcast in its entirety. And I'm charmed. Charmed, my friends. So thank you very much. Look, I it's not a career. I do this because I enjoy it. And I get something out of it creatively and spiritually, and it's nice to know a lot of people have made an effort to click the button, have a listen, and I hope gotten something out of it, whether relative to mental health or just from lighthearted banter. So thanks very much, and subscribe, tune in, stay with me, and we'll head for 1,000 downloads next. And it's interesting as, like, it's an interesting time to be producing a podcast. Producing makes it sound like this is very professional. And I am anything but. But overall, in the greater scheme of things, I mean, podcasting is booming. It's everywhere. And I suppose that makes sense because, look, it's conducive to social obedience. It's broad. It's choice. It's convenient. And it is whatever the listener wants it to be. From, you know, from the grounds of education, informative debate, to inspiration, and just the basics of audio comfort. There's opportunity, there's availability in subject and category, which just makes it relevant to everybody. And I think a big positive is that it's so disposable. I mean, you can pick what you like, and if you don't like it, you can move on. Cue a load of people hitting stop and moving on to the Tim Ferriss show. Stay with me. But, I mean, what works for me? Why do I listen to podcasts? Well, with work, I spend a lot of time in the car. So drive time, it's a perfect time for me to hook up, even walking, out running. It just that time, different times and different placements in my day. It's accessible and convenient, and I have that freedom the same as everybody. And probably a natural advance for me as growing up, particularly my work day, I had this kind of emotional attachment to radio. And anybody remember the Ray Darcy show not that long ago when it struck the balance greatly of fun and seriosity? Better than anyone. Good times. Good times indeed. But I think the material and the discussion in different formats, whether short shows or long form discussion, it makes a lot of radio pretty obsolete. And I think it goes back to freedom and independence. As somebody like myself, you're putting a podcast together, it's a free app on my phone that I just hit record and I put it out there. It's published. The app actually publishes it everywhere through different mediums. You're not going through a production team or an editorial team. It's the same way you'd write a blog. You just put it out there. It's just through an audio form. And the convenience is a big thing. We all know that. So podcasting, it's trending and it's here to stay. So it's a special week. My son Jace, he's 2 on Friday. So October, it's full of fluffiness, wistfulness, and brown leaves. A lot of throwbacks, a lot of reminders. And at present, I'm actually just looking down at the floor of discarded bubble wrap and torn boxing and pieces of a ridiculous jigsaw, mental jigsaw, that I'm fretting about. So it's some form of train set I need to put together. And yeah, I spoke last week on the podcast about procrastinating, and I'm going to be a complete hypocrite because I've been staring at this thing for about 2 days, just trying to figure out how on earth I'm going to get started and not disappoint my two-year-old child on the morning of his birthday. Yeah. If you were a fan of The Simpsons, you may remember that episode where Homer was supposed to build the barbecue. And if you haven't seen it, just YouTube Homer Builds Barbecue. Yeah, that's me right now. The pressures. The pressures of fatherhood. And it's actually, it is the pressures of fatherhood that I want to discuss this week. With the topic of mental head. I do this every week. I like to get into this big role of conversation. Then I trip up on a word. Something else comes out. Makes me sound like an idiot. And all momentum is lost. So, fatherhood and mental health. It is not like the films. They do not burst you through in a trolley. And you give birth 10 minutes later and everybody's smiling. I was nearly building a fucking statue of Cheryl after she gave birth. A 21-hour labour. It is, wow. It's a very exclusive experience in becoming a parent. And I don't mean that to sound condescending or patronising anyone who isn't a parent, but just within yourself, it's exclusive, it's different. Become a full, your first time as a parent, you're only going to experience this once. And I'd imagine your second, third, fourth child, it's maybe a different feeling. I don't know. Don't have that reference point. But there's no manual. There's no paint by numbers. It's a pleasure and a constant demand that's just always out of balance. And like it can test your resolve to the utmost. And for me, as someone who has struggled with confidence right throughout my life, and that's often trailered closely by low mood, I fatally earmarked becoming a father as this end game, as the result, the quick fix to all my internal struggles that I had right through my life. And that this little person was, he was the solution. He'd bring the best out of me, bring the best of me to the fore. And I'd be confident, I'd be loving, I'd be warm. And I'd have that golden realisation the moment he was born that nothing else in the world mattered. That I'd never have to worry about anything trivial in the world ever again. And that, my friends, is the fucking fantasist's approach to personal development. And naturally, it did not and it has not unfolded in that way whatsoever. So, I struggle with fatherhood. I struggle being a dad. I struggle with it the same way I struggle with pretty much every other area in my life when it comes to assuredness, assertiveness, confidence in myself. And like 3 weeks before Jace was born, I was out of work. I was emotionally floored. The pressure and expectation of what was en route, it just had me in a tizzy, to put it lightly. I believed I wasn't capable of being a father, that I had nothing to offer this child, and like nothing extra that could be offered to him from someone else. It was a really horrible, horrible experience. And look, I mean, after he was born, it's like I regularly held him. I felt nothing, and I fucking hated myself for it. I've shone away from responsibility. I justified it because I saw myself as a fucking coward. And I'm very fortunate. I mean, look, Cher's family, my own family, they have this incredible loud love for Jace, which is amazing for him. Like, to have that and more in his life, it's truly beautiful. He's growing up with love around him. But in those first few months, when I watched other people just roll over him with this passion and this kind of resounding affection, like right from day one, like I formed this conclusion that, he has enough love in his life, he doesn't need me. And I was useless. what could I bring to this? And this is me in a nutshell. This is why. This is what I struggle with. If I form an opinion, it's absolute in my head when it comes to negative mental health. When that's embedded in, it's very fucking difficult for me to remove that and change the narrative. And that is why I have to work on myself all the time. And I mean, look, I couldn't handle the cries, the pressure. I couldn't handle the uncertainty of what to do. And I'm for the first time in my life, it actually brought on these kind of mini panic attacks. And the only way I can describe it is like having a nail driven into the side of my head as my heart raced and my hands were shut. My hands began to shake, and I kind of had this silent cry. And that does not do much good for your mental health overall. Like, look, I'm sure it looked great from the outside. Brought him on a walk every day in the pram. Like a good fucking trailer for a bad movie. It's easy to look good and be good when things are good. But the feeling capable of ownership when the shit is going down in the middle of the night, like, that's an issue not just for me, but for him as well. And you know, I'm very fortunate. Like, holy fuck, Cher is an unbelievable mother, an incredible mother. Like most mothers, they just take to this naturally. And she's incredibly supportive, knowing that I am pretty much fucked in the head in every area of my life. And she's held the whole operation together. She's been brilliant. And knowing that Jace has that figure as a mother in his life is so reassuring. And it's, you know, it's that dependence that's the greatest scourge of growth. And I've depended on so many people over these 2 years that, like, look, I avoid putting myself into situations where I need to act independently with Jace. I've been afraid of it. I've been fucking terrified of it, and I'm not afraid to say that. And if there's other people listening to this who are maybe first-time dads or, same, a couple of years, have a couple of kids, I hope it's something you can relate to. If it's something you have been feeling, I'm happy enough to say this and hope that recognising it in someone else will give you assurance that, look, being a parent is feckin' difficult. And when it comes to counselling and therapy with mental health, I'm always open to it, 100%. I always trump it, I champion it to others, I champion it to myself. I've enjoyed counselling session and got so much out of them. When it comes to parenting, parent therapy and counselling as a father, I'm terrified. I'm so worried that the diagnosis could be so severe that, like, yeah, listen, hard luck, Dave, you're not qualified to be a dad. It scares the crap out of me. Look, my reassurance on this, and I'd say most people are listening to this saying, sweet mother of divine, sort your life out. I'm trying to. Like, sometimes my best is fucked up, but I have to accept that it's my best. And I'm trying. I'm trying my best. And I'll keep trying because, look, he's a happy child. He loves to play. He loves to be chased. He loves to be courted. Loves to be outdoors. And there's so many beautiful moments and memories over those 2 years that remain sewn into my heart that I cherish that quiet. I cherish that quiet love with him. Like, I embrace them, just those moments, those times I can silently kiss his cheek or his forehead without me even realising that such a small act can be the greatest portrayal of love I can give. And, you know, like, even you see him sleep at night. Any parent will get that. Like, he's still a baby at night when he's sleeping. There's peace. Peace you want to protect. That perfection, that potential in a little life. And look, I'm trying hard to work on being a dad that will stand by him, guide him and inspire him. And look, I have some lovely memories. Namely, the 4 a.m. feeds. I had a 4 a.m. feed playlist on Spotify that was quite soothing. And there's one song that it actually brings me to tears still. And it's an unusual one. It's a nice title. New Order, Your Silent Face. Your silent face is perfect. It sums it all up. He's looking up at you 4 in the morning. You're half asleep. and there's just his innocence and beauty as he looks back at you. And even now, if I put it on, I get that feeling in my stomach, and it's perfect. It's just perfect, and it's touching. It's somber, and actually, if you read the lyrics to the song, I think it is quite somber. I think it's actually about debt and perceptions of debt and illusions of debt. I'm not actually quite sure, but I'm going to stick with the title and the beautiful melody of the song. If you haven't heard it, New Order, Your Silent Face. But yeah, being a father, there you go, it's a difficult one, but I'm trying. That's my only finishing note on it, is I'm trying, and I continue to try, because I want to be there and I want to love him. Happy birthday, son. I love you. So things can get a bit heavy in this podcast. Mental health awareness, mental health discussions, and that's the way of it. Look, I'd love to come on and talk about doing morning yoga with the happy pair as the sun came up on Black Rock Beach, but that's not my life. For me, mental health, progression, understanding, awareness. We need to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. And when it comes to depression, anxiety, every angle under that umbrella of mental health, it's fucking harrowing. It's not pleasant. It's not nice. And there's details of which for everybody that aren't nice for people to hear. But look, I try and keep it raw. I try and keep an essence of integrity and sincerity as to what I talk about. And if that's where I'm at in my life, I'm not going to say I'm happy to share it with it, but it's important for me. It's important for me to use this platform as a base of truth as to where I'm at in life. And I don't want to sugarcoat that. A lot of mental health awareness can be quite vanilla. It can be quite sugarcoated. It can be quite safe. And look, a lot of it isn't fucking nice. And that's the reality of it. But as always, I do like to start off with the heavy stuff every week and then move on to much lighter goings on in my life. And not that it's very important, but I started watching True Detective again this week, season 1, starring Woody Harrelson, Matthew McConaughey. And there's a guy, Matthew McConaughey, he's like the fella you got stuck beside every year in school and you couldn't stand a hack of him. You thought he was an idiot, and then you met him again 15 years later and realised, Jesus, this guy is actually sound. And his career has been on a serious upward arc in recent years. He's put in some tight performances on screen. Interstellar, quite high profile. That was amazing viewing. Backed up perfectly by another splendid Hans Zimmer soundtrack. It is a film you had to see in the cinema. It was a video and audio spectacular, and it was a 3-hour film, and in that 3 hours when we went to see it, no one even left to go to the toilet. They were just really taken in by it. And I wouldn't be big on sci-fi, that end of entertainment and film, but Jesus, this took me in. I felt I was there. Bizarre film. It was Christopher Nolan. For once I thought, Jesus, this is quite normal for Christopher Nolan. And then boom, all hell broke loose. But yeah, McConaughey was loving in that. He was endearing. A father trying to get back to his daughter. And a son he didn't really seem to give a shit about. But check it out if you haven't seen it. Good film. He also did that film Mud. That was a bit unusual. I didn't quite get that. I couldn't get into that. It was a bit slow, but good performance all the same. And then, of course, Dallas Buyers Club. What was his name in that? Ron... Oh, it was quite a peculiar name. Ron Woodroof. True story. Guy with HIV. Really uncomfortable watch. We're talking about mental health being uncomfortable. Jesus, this is one of the most uncomfortable films I've ever watched. It was just this foul visual portrait, just this gaunt individual. And like, I felt like I was sick watching it. It was just, and again, powerful. It took you in, which is a testament to the performance. And
like, he lost a serious amount of weight for that. And that, it's one of them you're watching and asking yourself, like, what lengths do actors go to reach what is required to play a role in its required perfection? And Christian Bale did something similar for a movie called The Machinist. If you haven't seen The Machinist, it would be of the same ilk as Fight Club. In every way, right down to a social science perspective, it's it is deep. I think he got down to 8 stone, something like that, at an apple a day for a month just to get the weight down. And again, you're sort of looking saying, Jesus, how far do these artists go? Like, how much health do you put at risk for the benefit of career and reputation? And ultimately for entertainment. But that's why we love it. That's why it's an art. Anywho, True Detective. Yeah, it's a cop show, detective show, whodunit, murder mystery, falls under all those categories. Written by a guy called Nick Pizzolatto. Probably pronounced that wrong. Great name, though. And for me, when it comes to series, like, my standards are ridiculously high. I won't just settle for anything. This stems from the fact that one of the first ever series I watched was The Wire. Another police shot all those years ago, which was a slow burner. It was one of the originals. And it was a slow burner, but my God, it just set the standard for me, and that's what I kind of bounce off. That's the standard bearer for me. But True Detective, it hit it. It got up there. And my first thoughts watching True Detective, so McConaughey and Woody Harrelson are two main guys in it. nothing sort of unusual about the setup. You've got two cops partnered with two different moral arguments. And this kind of dysfunctional relationship, professional relationship, with this sort of tense personal relationship at the forefront as well. But when you're watching it right from the first episode, for me, you're looking saying, right, whatever team of writers they had on this, like, they nailed it. And the secret behind it is they actually got novelists in. It was actual writers, novelists in to script up the dialogue. And if you watch a lot of series and a lot of movies, it kind of stands out. Like, the dialogue is deep, and McConaughey's character, Russ Cole, yeah, he's just this, he's an absolute genius. this sort of pseudo genius. He has this kind of amateur approach to philosophy and psychology, a bit like myself. But this guy is, he goes another layer deep. I mean, some of the lines, I wrote this one down, and these are his thoughts, and this fragmented approach to the human condition. He says, I think the honourable thing for our species to do is to deny our programming, stop reproducing, and walk hand in hand into extinction. That's fucking marvellous. Marvellous. So Dennis Lehane, who is the guy who wrote Shutter Island and a couple of other crime books that were advanced into films. So he was one of the big writers on this. But it's the way it's done, it's not just about the murder. It's not just a detective show. It's this look at, it's a rumination of masculinity and just the nature of desire and obsession. And again, that human condition. And it has this very kind of unique, broken time structure. So you're introduced to the guys in 1995, and then it jumps forward to this kind of interrogation, almost a therapy of the two guys in 2012, where they just look they look old and ragged. And even the makeup, the production base, when you look at McConaughey's character in 2012 compared to 95, it's actually, you're sort of looking saying, Jesus, was it makeup to make him look young or makeup to make him look old? It's he just looks like the shadow of a raggy Jesus in the latter scenes. But the split sequencing, that's what works. It's a perfect arrangement for the progress of the story and the murder mystery as such. And it's about character art, it's about relationship, and the director nails it. For me, it was a very original approach. And this isn't my toast to creativity this week. I didn't mean to go so deep about True Detective, but it's such a good show. Happy enough to talk about it. It's a bit of a slow burner, but I think audiences are a bit more used to that now. Maybe they're not. Maybe concentration levels are poison. I'm only speaking that on my behalf. I don't really know. But do check it out. True Detective, Season 1. It's as close to perfect as you will get. Go check it out.
So to move on from Russ Cole / Matthew McConaughey's morbid philosophical digressions in True Detective, I'm delighted to finally move on to this week's Toast to Creativity. So each week I just pick, whether it's an artist, an athlete, it could be a book, a film, just something that's interesting. In previous weeks, I always highlight this. We've looked at, I always go back to them, OJ Adventures, climbing chimneys and towers at ridiculous heights, teasing debt all around the world. Last week I looked at the work of Stephen Pressfield. He wrote a wonderful book called The War of Art, which I need to get back to. I only covered the first part and I want to open up on the second part, which I will do. But for this week, I've come across a gentleman by the name of Yusuf Ahmadi. Now, my apologies if I've pronounced that incorrectly, but I mean well. So Yusuf, he's a biomedical graduate by qualification. Jack of all trades, master of all trades. But he's a YouTuber, which is a common description of a job or a career that didn't exist a couple of years ago. But I came across this guy on one of my random YouTube excursions, which do happen quite regularly, where you say, I'll just have a look at a video or two, and suddenly 4 hours later, you're still looking at stuff online. But he undertakes these... I don't know if it falls under the category of inspiring or creative or otherwise, but these random undertakings, these kind of outrageous incidental exercises. So to give an example, the first video I found, he hides in a Tesco store for 24 hours. Why? I don't know. And that's the compelling part for me. It's, I just want to know what his why is. So... His morals on it is, if he gets caught doing this, he hasn't broken the entry. Once he's asked to leave, he'll leave. So he basically goes into Tesco during the day when it's open and hides in the clothing section or behind the shelf and has to stay for 24 hours and then walks out the front door without anyone noticing. It's a brazen effort. It's probably not something I do. But I'm interested, what gets me on it, I just want to know his why and his motivation. And because of this, I followed on to his other video. So he does the same thing. He does it in McDonald's, he does it in Sainsbury's, he does it in the cinema. Just goes in, stays for 24 hours and leaves. So there you go. So he does a little bit of urban exploration. He goes through kind of abandoned towns, haunted graveyards and churches, and that type of stuff I've definitely come across before. But then, just going through his videos, there was one that caught my eye. He spent 24 hours in Old Trafford, which I thought, that's interesting. I said, because straight away I thought, surely the security protocols at Man United would be pretty high. So check this one out, it's a 20 minute video. And I think it's him and his brother, they pay in to do the tour, so which would obviously bring you through the museum and different areas of the grounds, the dressing rooms or whatever, and they break away from the tour and they hide in a cubicle in one of the toilets overnight. And I think the next day United are playing Arsenal, so they slum it out and they get to see a bit of a match. But when he's recording this, it's the middle of winter, like it showed, it's snowing out and everything. So I can't imagine 12, 13, however many hours he spent in a toilet cubicle beneath a football stadium was the most pleasant experience. But they get in, they're behind one of the goals, they're watching some of the game, they don't have tickets, they don't have seats. Security obviously figure out what's going on and they get removed, but the security are kind of laughing at them. They're sort of saying, like, fair play to you. So, yeah, I was stuck with that one. I suppose I can see the why, the motivation and that. You just can hide out, and if you get through, you get to see a match at the other end. So, and I think, you know, €70 a ticket probably, so we save you a few quid. It'd be cheaper to pay for the stadium tour than pay for the match ticket. So he also does, he does the same, couple of other videos, I stayed with him. He did the same in Arsenal, the Emirates, he did the same in West Ham, their new stadium. And then I found one, he said he did one in Chelsea, but there were a couple of videos tagged to the Chelsea one. I said, this looks interesting. I said, something might have gone down here. So, same thing, went to Stamford Bridge, him and his brother, paid in to do the tour. And same thing, they're hiding in one of the cubicles in the toilet. This is obviously the way. And he gets caught by security. But the whole thing just escalates really quickly. And it becomes quite aggressive. And there's 3, 4, 5 security guards that come down. And they're making demands. They're making sort of threats on him. They're demanding for him to give him his phone. So he's recording everything. They want him to delete everything. But, like, what strikes me about this guy, he's confident. And he's very shrewd. And he says it outright, he knows his rights, and he's basically telling them, like, he doesn't have to give him the phone, that not even the police can take his phone to delete content. So he's very much in control of the situation, which I would not be. I would be shitting myself. And he basically is telling these guys how to do their job. Now, this has all been recorded in a feckin' toilet underneath the stands in Stamford Bridge. And he's basically telling these guys, look, here's what you do, lads. Take me to the control room, verify who I am, and you can either send me home or ring the police to get me arrested. And they're accusing him of breaking an entry, of trespassing. And again, he throws it back. He says, the loophole here, he says, I purchased a tour ticket. He says, his argues his point that, listen, I'm doing you a favour. I'm highlighting the weakness in your security standards. And once I'm asked to leave, I leave. But they try and intimidate him. He's showing this footage while he's talking. One of them holds his fist up and he's just not getting intimidated at all. He's pretty calm. And then it goes from one extreme to the other. One of the guys offers him a Snickers and sort of trying to be his pal. It was really unusual. But again, like, you're watching this and it's sort of shaky footage. It's a bit claustrophobic because it's obviously a tight space. But it's, as I said, it's such a brazen effort. It's not something I do. It's, and it gets, as it goes on, again, it's about a 19-20 minute video. And it gets into a weird place. The police come, everything explained. But while he's giving his personal details to the police, one of the security are taking note of his details, of his name and address and everything. And there's one for you. Like, you're thinking that security staff, they're training. Right, lads, here's what you're going to do when you find 2 YouTubers hiding in the toilets. And you can see by them, by their reaction and that kind of aggression, that intimidation, they're really not sure what to do. And they seem really taken aback by it. But anywho, when he goes home that night, he's telling all this. He's just talking to the camera over the footage. And he's explaining what happened. But later that night when he gets home, he gets an email with this kind of cryptic threat, with the headline, for every action there is a reaction. And he gets another one then, sort of making, it makes a kind of a reference to sort of his background, and kind of references to Algerian background, which one of the security guards mentions he's Algerian. And it progressed. I'm trying to remember here. I watched this yesterday. That he gets another email then, which is completely fucked up. Your man emails with a picture of his girlfriend, basically saying, I know who your girlfriend is. But the guy is so calm. He's ridiculously calm about this. Now, I don't know if this is his business, if this is what he's pushing. He's happy enough to put out content like this, which I'd see is quite dangerous. I'd be escalating this to the police. Although I probably wouldn't be putting myself in a situation where I'm found hiding in the toilet in the football ground. But anywho, it is interesting. The rest of it, I don't know. I don't see the buzz of hiding in a closed section in Tesco. But this thing got it escalated quickly. Bit of chaos. And this guy actually finishes off by highlighting the details and IP addresses of the emails that were sent to hackers, basically saying, here's the details, security guards, lads. Do what you wish. So there you go. There's some crazy shit online. Usaf Ahmadi, YouTuber, biomedical graduate, amongst other things. Loads of crazy videos out there. Definitely original. I want to know his why, I want to know his motivation. I'm going to chase him down and see if I can find it. But go and have a look, see what you think for yourself. So for the final segment of episode 8, I spend my mental health podcast, I'm going to move on. Or I suppose move back to what I began talking about last week. Stephen Pressfield, The War of Art, a book about excuses. Of all things. So last week I explored the first section of his book, which is, he writes it in a context of writing and artistry, in that when we want to do something, when we want to create, here's the excuses we come up with, and here's how you need to handle it, and here's what you need to do to progress. And it was it was an interesting read for me. 60 pages of excuses right from the off, which shocked me, but also made sense to me when I read it. So that was book one, and I spoke about it last week. It was a focus on the excuses, and as he calls it, the resistance that holds us back, or that we allow to hold us back when we want to commit to getting something done. And it was taking up a lot of time. it was a long enough episode last week, and I was conscious of the fact it could very easily turn into a 3-hour episode if I dissected the book in its entirety. So this week I want to move on to book two, and he has his book broken into three parts. So book two, which he labels Turning Pro, Turning Pro is exactly what it says. He, for me, before reading this section of the book, like, I was on this, it was a familiar narrative for me that, you know, straight away, if you go half-arsed into something, the end result is going to be half-arsed. And if it's viewed as nothing more than a hobby, like, that's all it will ever be. And I'm talking here about anything we kind of enjoy doing, anything we want to commit to or currently commit to, but sort of appreciate it as only a hobby. That's what it always will be. And will it ever grow? Will it develop? Probably not. It'll just be kind of a nicety in our everyday lives. And I suppose an example, and one that will be very close to my own profession, and it's something I actually highlighted last week as well, was with the footballers that I work with. They make every effort to train, to prepare, and to perform as professionals. But the external detail and external viewpoint just sees them labelled as semi-professional. And semi to me is only half. That's, you're not all in, and which in my opinion is very unjust, and it's not fully appreciative of their commitment to what they give. And although it's an uncontrolled, distant viewpoint, it still indirectly affects a big picture. Even the marketing element of the sport, the sporting reputation and the potential in its branding and the club image and the player image. And that's a lot of detail, maybe not quite as solid a link to Pressfield's point, but it's just one that came to mind for me, just how we label something and perceive it. And something like semi-professional football gives a certain outlook for me, and it was one that came to mind. However, to kick off, Pressfield in book two, he addresses Turning Pro. He states that all defeated artists are defeated by resistance for the same reason, in that they're amateur. That's their mindset, they're amateur, and they haven't turned pro yet. And he emphasises that turning pro, that being a professional, is an ideal. It's not about, you know, tapping 100% into earning serious royalty, serious money and financial return for being a professional. Professional as an ideal. It's the mindset you begin with for your artistry, for your, whatever your, as I've mentioned, hobby, because we want to progress. We want to move from a hobby into something more. And amateur is a Latin word and it means to love. And it's a fact that he disputes in this. He argues that the amateur, in fact, doesn't love enough towards what he does, and that if he did, he'd pursue this craft, I suppose, with a kind of a distinct vocation, with a very real approach. And like, it makes sense. It really does. It's a really simple book, this. And again, to give those a reference point of simplicity of what he writes about, he gives a great reference point. Actually, he talks about turning pro, and I keep saying hobby, it's just probably an easiest way to kind of describe. He says, think about it in terms of your day job, if you want to develop. And I suppose for me, a good example would be this podcast. So he says, look, our day job, we show up every day, no matter what, you know, whether it's the traffic, the weather, we're early, we're late, we get in. And we're there all day, whether it's 9 to 5 or shift work. We're committed for the long haul. And, you know, even if we're careers and we're looking to advance, we're not going to jump ship of a, you know, regularly from job to job every 2 days or 3 days. We're generally there for a period of time. The stakes are quite high. We must perform. We must answer and perform. Otherwise, we're taken in and questioned about it. And ultimately, we work to earn. I mean, I wouldn't go to work if I didn't get paid. I mean, there's autonomy, control and reward in what I do, my day job. And that's the approach he wants us to take with our craft. And a big one is, this is interesting. If you look at our day job, we don't over-identify with our jobs. Like, we may take pride in our work, but it doesn't define us. We can remove ourselves, whereas the amateur approach is to do the opposite. It's to take it so seriously that you almost become paralysed. It becomes almost an identity crisis, that you want to be recognised so much for what you do, it ends up contradicting itself and ends up being a burden. So in our day job, like, we'll master our techniques and our trade. And also, lighter note, we'll have a sense of humour about what we do. And I'll give you a good one, my day job. I sell tampons. There you go. World's best tampon salesman. I'm going to get feedback about that. There's no doubt about it. But yeah, sense of humour, quite important. And then finally then, it's probably covered in other points that he highlights. We take accountability. We take blame. We take praise for what we do in our day jobs. I think he's bullet pointed. There's 10 of them there that he bullet points. And if we applied those principles into the art we have, into the hobby we have, whether it's sport or otherwise, it's unquestionable that we'd make strides, we'd progress in quality and in growth before long. So again, for me, I'm currently an amateur at this podcast, and if I was to apply those principles to this podcast over the next 3 or 4 months, it would take me further down the line. I'd be so much better at it. I'd be so much more confident at it. I'd be so much more committed to it. I do it because I enjoy it. I've said that. But if I can apply those principles to it, it makes sense. Why wouldn't it work? So the passages within this section are a little bit longer. Whereas the first book were just kind of short paragraphs, an introduction to sort of excuses, but he goes into a bit more detail with the passages in this particular section. But there's still recognisable shout-outs. He speaks about the professional being patient, and that's something I fall down on. I can kind of lack an acceptance for delayed gratification and a lot of things. And what I like to call Chapter 12 syndrome. You know, if I'm starting a degree course 4 years, day one, like, I'm switching to the end. I'm looking at the end of the book. Can't wait to get my hand on a degree. So that's a characteristic flaw I need to work on. But I think for me, The reason I fall down on that is I just get so enthusiastic and excited about shit. I kind of lose a bit of order and control. But again, it's another fair highlight. What else does he talk about? He talks about, again, he just makes a reference to excuses. He's a pro and never accept an excuse. He respect the excuses and the resistance that's in front of him. But he knows that kind of if he as much as makes eye contact with the excuse, and obviously a metaphor, like it's game over, the progress is lost. And this is a nice one. He labels it a pro, a professional plays it as it lays. I'm guessing that's some sort of sporting reference, golfing, where it lands, where the ball lands. But the professional conducts his business in the real world, facing adversity, injustice, bad calls and letdowns, accepting that the field isn't level. But he's not perturbed by any of it. He keeps going. There's no entitlement, and that shit's going to happen. No matter what happens, you keep going. Like, that is the basics of progress. No matter what you're doing, whether it's your job, your sport, you're learning something, you're doing your course, your degree, no matter what, if you have a trickle of fucking self-entitlement that you feel this should just happen for you, but you're gone, it's over. And I mean, it's the big pit. Why do you feel entitlement? It's back to your childhood. It's getting deep now. Always do this simple conversation, I start thinking of the bigger reasons behind something. I won't do that. We're late in the podcast. Entitlement, it'll fuck you up. You're not entitled to anything. You gotta work for it. So the timing of this book, it was perfect for me. As I kind of found myself sort of ambling professionally the past couple of months. And the reason for this is I set up a business last year and I fucking failed miserably. Failed fucking terribly. Actually, it was a spectacular failure. And in its aftermath, I suppose I've been guilty of that kind of comparison and just defeatism. And it, again, maybe it goes back to entitlement. Maybe I did sort of feel this should have worked, but it didn't. And the reason it didn't is for everything I've said already in this segment. I treat it like a hobby. I had an amateur approach. I lacked a belief in myself. And, you know, my own admission here was that the lay of the land was like, this is how it works. It'll be grand. But terrible approach. Really poor. Really amateur. I should have made it my vocation. And I should have made it work. And I didn't. And as a result, I've kind of started been scratching my head saying, Jesus, right, where am I going to next? But amidst all that sort of constitutional drift, like, I found a channel to sort of invest my vision of myself through a couple of things, namely through the endurance challenges that I've taken up. If I didn't set up the business, I don't think I would have had the confidence to pursue and undertake the crazy challenges that I love doing. And also, again, this podcast, it's a perfect channel for my creativity and just to express my opinions on certain things. And where I'm at now is my urges are kind of now to sort of flourish and promote my efforts into this podcast to sort of keep going. And just from reading this book, I'm kind of saying, right, well, let's take this guy's principles. What's the worst that could happen? And look, that's me questioning you. That's why I'm raising these sort of books. That's why I'm talking about these sort of books and these topics. Like, what's in it for you? Just have a look at your life. Have a look at what you're interested in, whether it is your day job or whatever your hobby is, if it's going to the gym, if it's reading or writing, if it's painting pictures, whatever the fuck it is. Where do you want to go with it? That's my question for you this week, just to finish off in the podcast. Where do you want to go with it? What sort of vision do you have for yourself with it? Is it just a hobby? Are you happy with that? Perfect. Is there something more buried within you that you want to sort of explore, and where you can go with it? So ask yourself that. What am I good at? What do I do? What do I enjoy? Where do I want to go with? And I sound like a fucking priest on the altar. I know that. But this is how conversation starts. So get back to me. Let me know. Is Stephen Pressfield's work that I'm talking about any use to you? Is it a load of nonsense? Am I talking shite? Have I gone overboard? It's all relative. Please let me know. There you go. End of book two. We'll head on to book three next week. Gets a bit freaky. Starts talking about angels and grass growing. But important to finish it out. So there you go. Episode 8. We survived. Longest episode yet. That's fine. I think that maybe means I'm getting a bit more confident in sort of exploring different topics and expanding in conversation. If it's too long, again, let me know. Feedback is vital. And we've been getting good feedback. So keep it coming. Send the messages in. Subscribe, download, stay tuned. Tell your mates. Share it on Twitter. Share it on Instagram. Share it on Facebook. Give me a follow, performance_doc. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll talk to you again next week.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.